Questions about anything? So, exam is scheduled for 8 a.m. on Tuesday. I don't know if you want to have a help session or not. I mean, the help study day would be the logical day. You want to talk about that now or next day, last day? Now is as good a time as any. Morning, afternoon, evening? Morning? Is the definition of morning this time?
Yes, I've got, it doesn't matter, I might not come in, but I've got things all afternoon.
So 9:40 on study day? Just like a normal class day? So the final will be similar to your other exams, except proportionately longer because there's more time. In fact, I usually make the final by putting your old exams into a word processor and then struggling hard to delete questions. There will be genuinely new questions, particularly on the material since exam three, but there'll be lots of old questions too. Structure is basically the same. They're going to be, I think, 35 true-false, 25 short answer, 8 longer questions. And I guess I haven't quite decided whether and slash how to do the identify star sort of problem. There are kind of two things to, and I'll try and tell you which I choose before, and there are kind of two ways to go. One way would be to do the winner hexagon again, because that has lots of stars and constellations this time. And the other way to go would be to just do constellations again like exam two, but now ask you to name any important star that's in those constellations. I don't know. Either way, you're supposed to know all of the stuff that you needed to know for exam twos and threes, the names of stars and the dots for constellations. But I'll probably test it one of those two ways. Questions? Okay, so most of the time last time we were talking about active galaxies. So active galaxies are kind of the problem from the 60s. These strange objects, quasars, were detected with radio telescopes. Didn't really expect radio telescopes to see stars, and turns out they're not stars, they're whole galaxies. After a little bit of fooling around, people figured out that they were hugely distant, had huge Doppler shifts, and they had to be hugely luminous. And in fact, they're among the most distant objects we can see. So these days, kind of their importance is that since they're highly luminous, we can see them kind of on the edge of the visible universe. Historically, they're also important as one of the early examples of evolution. That is to say, we've said that these days we can see that spiral galaxies were a little bit brighter in the past than they are today, but it's kind of a subtle effect. In the 60s, you can see a very huge effect with quasars. They were hugely present around 1 billion years after the Big Bang, and they're not very present today. So there's a huge spike of quasar production, as it were, soon after the Big Bang that is not currently ongoing. So this diverse set of objects, Cepheids, quasars, radio galaxies being the main ones, but also blazars, which are considerably rare, these days we think that they're all basically the same thing. They're cases where we have accretion, which is to say mass is being dumped on a huge black hole, and the differences we see in these guys are just based on the point of view. So in particular, if we see side view, then we see the jets that are producing these big radio lobes of a radio galaxy. If we're looking down the throat of one of these black holes, then we're going to see more energetic phenomena like the quasars and the blazars. So here's kind of the picture, usual picture, black hole, stuff getting in. Friction heats it to real high temperatures, so we get X-ray production. We get excited gas surrounding it. And since this stuff is moving at very high speeds, we have the potential to see really high Doppler shifts. So in particular, for Cepheids, you remember those are spirals which have a particularly bright nucleus. The big difference between type 1 and type 2 is whether we're seeing directly this very high speed moving gas that's surrounding the black hole. That depends on whether we're going to have emission lines that are broad, showing a big Doppler shift, or if that is covered up by us, obscured by the dust in the spiral galaxy, then we'll just have the emission lines from this larger region. So it makes these things unusual. Well, here's a long list of unusual aspects. Unusual color, broadly defined. So these things are often sources of X-rays and, for that matter, radio, which neither of which are very prominent in stars. The spectrum that we get is continuous as if it were a thermal spectrum, but it doesn't have the proper shape. It has an unusually large amount of blue, which is to say from X-ray to ultraviolet to maybe a little bit of actual blue light. So the source of this non-thermal spectrum we don't think is a hot object. It's actually synchrotron radiation. Remember, synchrotron radiation is like your microwave. It's due to high-speed electrons rotating in a magnetic field. That's what's causing the acceleration that's producing the light. Usually we think about synchrotron radiation as being radio light, but here the electrons are so energetic that it's actually producing visible light. The energy of the electrons actually determines the energy of the light that it produces. Emission lines. Typically stars don't have emission lines. They have absorption lines. And very commonly, the absorption lines are broad, which means that we're seeing high-speed material in orbit around a black hole. Thermal light from the sun is not polarized, but the light from quasars is not uncommonly polarized. And we have two ways of polarization. We've got reflected light, and/or turns out that radio antennas can also produce polarized light. So I went to YouTube and I could find with care this old commercial that I told you about. So it's still there, actually in German, oddly enough. We also see unusual shapes for these objects, the huge lobes of radio galaxies, relativistic jets, all of that sort of stuff. So all of these objects are classified together under AGN, active galactic nuclei. Questions on these things? Relatively rare, hugely bright, particularly rare these days, not so rare in the past, objects. And we think we understand how they work. The overall question is how they formed so early on. So among the earliest forming objects are these big black holes, and it's hard to see how you could get that much mass together right there at the start. Questions? Okay, so we've got this television show these days that is the topic for the... So that's the tune, if you haven't heard it, at least the start of it. And the key word I want you to see is the whole universe. So I think probably even in the start to that thing, they have kind of a picture of something that looks like a firecracker going off, and that's kind of the wrong picture for a Big Bang. The Big Bang happened every place. There was no empty space that material moved into. So if you have problems with a universe that is totally filled and expanding, one way out of it is just to realize the out that is infinity. Twice infinity still fits into infinity just fine. You can double the size of the number line and it still has exactly the same number of numbers as it had before. If you want to pursue that, I have a Xerox of a somewhat humorous handout that deals with a hotel that has an infinite number of rooms. And you can do all sorts of clever things to fit infinite numbers of people into infinite numbers of rooms. So what started out going back pretty much to Einstein's day is as an assumption, but these days it's more or less a direct observation, and that is that the universe seems to be more or less the same. So we have the structure of the universe that is this kind of foam of voids and walls and filaments, and as far as we can tell, you could stamp that over the entire universe and it would look pretty much the same. So no edge, no expanding stuff. We have kind of the unusual phenomena, though, that you also have to keep in mind, and it's maybe hard to keep in mind both of these at the same time. So, I mean, here is the dense universe, here is the current version of the universe, but we want to be careful to remember what we're actually going to see. Because as we go further and further from Earth, we're looking further and further back in time. And eventually, at a distance of 13.7 light years, we should see the Big Bang happening in every direction. So we actually do look like we are at the center of something. We're at the center of this sphere that is the Big Bang happening every place else except here. So this is a phenomena that's caused by the look-back effect, right? So we think that if we actually went to this spot that looks like it's the Big Bang happening now, it would look like what's happening here, right? There'd be galaxies there and planets and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so we seem to be surrounded by the Big Bang happening every place else around us, but it's an illusion caused by the look-back effect, that if we're looking at great distances, we're seeing the past. There's a, yep?
How close have we gotten to getting to being able to do that distance?
So, we'll talk lots more about that, but kind of the short answer to your question is, we might think about, well, maybe it's not that short of an answer. If we think about the sun, how close can we get to the center of the sun, which is also something that's hot and dense? And the sun becomes opaque at some point that we call the surface of the sun, right? There's stuff above that and there's stuff below that, but we can't see into it. And that opaqueness comes about when we start to have ionized gas. So we can see back to where the universe started to be made out of neutral material as opposed to ionized material, when it cooled off enough so that the electrons and atoms combined to form neutral atoms, which is then transparent to light. And the answer to that is pretty much 380,000 years. That's as far back as you can see with visible light, because earlier than that, the universe was opaque to visible light. And I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. We can actually do better than that for the same reason we can do better than the sun. For the sun, if we wanted to see the inside, it was opaque to visible light, but not opaque to sound. So we can actually hear sounds that are from earlier times of the Big Bang. And that's going to push us back considerably closer than that. And there are other relics that are left over from the Big Bang. So we have really good direct evidence back to about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. And things are pretty simple, actually, in the Big Bang. So we can reproduce those things in our lab, and we can push it back to times. So this is not direct observation, but seeing how it had to be. And we can push it back to times that are on the order of a billionth of a second. Clearly, that is to say, we can run those conditions in the lab and see how it works. So there's a large range of various types of speculation where things become increasingly fuzzy. But we can't go earlier than about 10 to the minus 37 seconds. That's where general relativity, we know general relativity fails if matter is crunched together, like at the center of a black hole. And times earlier than that, I refuse to talk about. There are people who are happy to go to negative times and talk about what the universe was like. And that allows you to ask questions like somebody asked last time, what caused the Big Bang? I'm going to refuse to answer that question because I'm very skeptical about times earlier than zero. Other people are bolder than I am and happily talk about times earlier than zero. What I can say for sure is that there's no current evidence for anything happening before time equals zero, let alone times that are earlier than 10 to the minus 37 seconds. And you know, you can kind of depend where you want to cut off your belief in the calculations, but things work pretty well to incredibly early times. To put kind of another quasi number up here, roughly speaking, at a billion years after the Big Bang, things are not that different from the way they are today. So galaxies, stars, that sort of stuff has all happened by a billion years. And of course, we're 13.7 billion years, 12.7 after that. And we're not in the first generation, right? Because the Earth was formed about 4.6, 4.7 billion years ago. So there's a lot that happened before the Earth formed, right? We had to produce all of the carbon that's in us in other stars first.
Going back to 380,000 years ago thing, are you saying that if we were to time travel back to the period before that, we wouldn't be able to see anything?
Yeah, it would be like being inside the sun. It would be foggy. The light wouldn't go very far before it would be absorbed. So you can maybe see the hand in front of you, but you couldn't see, you know, down the block. So light was still propagating, just as it's propagating in the sun, but it's going really short distance before it's being absorbed.
And that's the way it was on Earth and everywhere?
Well, there was no Earth, right? Yeah, but so if you look at this picture, right, so I don't know, maybe this is not a good thing to point at. Well, maybe, I guess it's not a good thing to point at because it stresses so many things. So we're talking here times from time equals zero. So the Earth formed about 9 billion years after the Big Bang. So that we have, right, 13.7 is the current time, and it took about 4.6, 4.7 billion years in order for the Earth to form. So it's a way later phenomena.
Oh, is 380,000, is that...
That's
80,000 years after the Big Bang?
Yes.
Oh.
Yep. So that's measuring it from the other end.
I thought you meant a double.
Nope. So here we are now, and here we are at the Big Bang, and here's this time we're talking about, and we can go back 4.6 billion years, and the whole span is this 13.7 billion years. More questions? So another thing that is kind of confusing is Hubble's law, which says that everything seems to be moving away from us, kind of like in this picture. That seems to imply that we're at a special location, namely the center of an explosion. And it turns out if you just do the math, then anyone in any galaxy would come to the same conclusion, that everything seems to be moving away from them. So here's this guy, this galaxy that we see moving away from us fast. If we just figure how things would look to him, if Hubble's law were valid, it would also look like everything's moving away from him. So the Hubble's law, which seems like an explosion, is not in fact good evidence. But we can, anybody can calculate the time it took for when everything was on top of everything else. And to figure out that time, we just need to take the distance divided by the velocity, and you work out what that means for Hubble's law, which I guess I'm not sure I wrote down anyplace. You all remember it from the past. I guess I didn't. So the velocities are proportional to the... Oh, there it is. Okay. So roughly speaking, the time since the Big Bang should be 1 over Hubble's constant. Hubble's constant is about 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec in the strange unit that astronomers like. And if you take 1 over that and use the unit conversion, it turns out that that's about 14 billion years. And that the fact that 14 is pretty close to 13.7 is actually not, it's not strong evidence. I will do note that we call this thing Hubble's constant, but it's not constant, right? In the early universe, when the time since the Big Bang was shorter, Hubble's constant had to be correspondingly bigger. So Hubble's constant is something that is changing with time. It's not literally a constant. We typically measure things cosmologically with this parameter called Z, which is based on the Doppler shift. Right, so the Doppler shift is the change in the wavelength that we observe this emission line at divided by the wavelength that it's in our laboratory. And for typical objects near us, the change in wavelength is small, like a part in 10,000. But if we go to further and further things, we'll have, for the most distant galaxies, expansion factors that are like 7, and the most distant light source we can see has an expansion factor of about 1,000. Right, so if you just rearrange this equation, the wavelength that we observe divided by the wavelength in our laboratories is 1 plus this parameter that's called Z. Questions? Okay, so where we quit last time was on Ober's paradox. And so Ober's paradox, it goes back to the Middle Ages. It's the conclusion that it should be bright at night, which is, of course, not the case. That's why it's called the paradox. It comes to a contrary-to-fact conclusion. So first of all, let's explain why Ober thought it should be bright at night. And this is a terrible picture, but if you go out into the woods now and you look around, what do you see? You look all around in the deep woods and all you see is bark, right? Because every sight line that you look at is going to end on the trunk of a tree. And if the forest is actually infinite, even if the trees are pretty far apart, infinity works the way that still every sight line should end on a tree. So if you have kind of Newton's picture of the universe, stars are tiny, but if they're actually sprinkled randomly every place, then every sight line should end on the surface of the star, so everything should look like looking at the sun. It should be bright. Those stars are tremendously distant, so their angular size gets smaller and smaller and smaller, but if there are an infinite number of stars, every sight line has to end on the surface of a star. We see black space between the stars, that shouldn't be the case. Every place should be as bright as the surface of the sun. Okay, so Ober's paradox is in an infinite universe, with randomly put stars, the result is that every sight line has to end on a star, so no matter where you look, you should be looking at the surface of a star, which looks just like the surface of the sun. It's very bright. Okay, so that's not the case, right? So where is the flaw in Ober's paradox? Well, what about distance?
We can't
see light. Say again?
We can't see light as far away as we just said.
So tell me more. Why can't we see light? Ben.
It's like, dust.
So dust is certainly one thing that's going to interrupt the light, but if you follow Ober's paradox through, those dust particles should also be surrounded by an oven that is at the temperature of a surface of a star. And so it should be cooked to the temperature of the surface of a star, and you know that dust can't exist at those temperatures. So right, everything should be cooked until it is at the temperature of the surface of stars, right? Because we'd be in an oven. So I don't know, it seems funny, and one of the things that may seem funny is, of course, we've said that stars look dimmer as we get further and further away, and I don't seem to have accounted for that. But fundamentally, the reason they get dimmer is, of course, because their angular size gets smaller, and that we have accounted for. So even though these are very, very distant stars, and their surface is going to subtend a very tiny angle, every direction should be filled with them. Yeah, but that, so it is true that, stars cluster first into clusters in our galaxy and into galaxies, into superclusters, but it doesn't really matter, right? So if I think of galaxies being sprinkled around, or if I think of this foam being sprinkled around uniformly, still every sight line should end on the surface of a star, and it should be bright. Say again?
The stars that we do actually see so bright that they jump out or block the other stars that we should see?
Maybe. There's a lot of truth to that, but we have to see why it would drown out those other stars. Well, right, the infinite is problematic, right? So one way or the other, we have to kind of get rid of infinity if we're going to solve this paradox. So one way this paradox could easily be solved is if the forest was finite sized, right? So in, you know, if the forest is just the size of a few trees with an edge, then you can see through the forest and you can see through it, right? So we could have a finite universe. But that contradicts what we've said over there, but it would at least solve the problem. We could also make so this was making the universe finite in size. We could also make the universe finite in time. Right? So if the universe has only been around 13.7 billion light years, then the light from those distant stars that maybe exist hasn't reached us yet. We can only see the stars that are within a certain distance to us, and effectively it's made finite. And probably another out that's important is the Doppler effect. Because remember that for distant stars, they're going to be moving away from us quickly, and so the light they produce is no longer going to be visible light, right? It's going to be shifted to longer and longer wavelengths, and eventually into wavelengths that our eye can't detect. And in that sense, it turns out it is true. Go ahead. So what we've said is that, in fact, we do seem to be surrounded in every direction by this light that is produced from the Big Bang. So yeah, if our eyes were tuned to longer and longer wavelengths, we'd see more and more of the visible universe. So practically speaking, people who look at galaxies tell us that as you go to greater and greater exposures, the galaxies really are cheek to jowl. But they're, of course, shifted to hugely red wavelengths, infrared wavelengths, in fact, that we can't see with our eye. Okay, so Ober's paradox kind of immediately tells us that Newton's view of the universe, stars sprinkled every place, can't, and steady in time, can't really be the case. There has to be something that's finite about our universe. And we think what's finite about our universe is that it's only been around a certain length of time. And what's also finite about the properties of the Doppler effect also mean that even if it had been around for a long time, we couldn't see those most distant objects with our eyes one way or the other.
What does it mean to say that we've only been around a certain amount of time? Because isn't that kind of a silly statement?
Say again?
Well, like, to me it's like saying that we just have this, all this insane mass just came out of nowhere. Like, there it is, here it is, here it's not. But that doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
Well,
so you can actually argue that the universe is nothing, that if you add up the amount of positive energy and negative energy, you get zero. But those sorts of calculations are tricky, and it's not clear that it is going to come out to be zero. But I guess I don't have any particular problems with starting. So if you want, you can go back. There are people who happily look for causes of the Big Bang, looking at times before zero, but they don't include me. Well, why does there obviously have to be something before it? Well, certainly today we can't make something from nothing. But I'm not so confident that we could never make something from nothing. So as I say, there are theories that look at times before time equals zero. But they're necessarily speculative because there's nothing you can say about times earlier than zero. We can't get, no matter what, you can't get past the problems of quantum mechanics and gravity, the so-called quantum gravity problem, which has to do with, give it a name, the Planck time. So the Planck time is the time when the material in the universe is so concentrated that general relativity would have effects on the quantum properties. And we just have no idea how to calculate that. So to give you kind of a flavor for folks who are interested in times before time equals zero, the idea is to come up with something called the multiverse. And so in some huge dimensional space, the idea is that whole universes, pop into existence out of vacuum fluctuations, which is possible, but that there can be no connection between those universes. So even if there are zillions of other universes in this multidimensional space, there's absolutely no way we can contact those universes. So we're not talking about different galaxies, we're talking about different universes that might be totally different, might have different charges on the electron, might have no commonality between our universe and those universes. Incidentally, one of the reasons that people like the multiverse is that it explains the unusual fitness of this universe for life, right? So it turns out that if you look at the fundamental constants like Newton's gravitational constant and the charge of an electron and the Weinberg angle, it turns out that if those were very different from what they are, you wouldn't have any sort of possibility of having atoms, and hence you wouldn't have any possibility of having light. So the idea with these multiverse people is that universes are always popping into existence. Most of them are not favorable for life. The one in a zillion that is favorable to life is ours. So that's why we're around. That's why conditions are nice for life, because we live in the one universe, well, maybe not one, would be an infinite number of them, but we live in the rare universe that has the physical constants adjusted just right for life. More questions? So there are a lot, So I repeat, my personal stance is it doesn't make any sense to talk about things earlier than the Planck time because there just isn't any theory that's up to the task. So people who are into the multiverse theory kind of make up toy versions that maybe are supposed to shed some light on things. And it's not a hopeless situation. Theories of, I think I've told you before, that string theory is the candidate theory for quantum gravity. And so if we can ever figure out how string theory or a better theory works, then maybe we could push things back to earlier times. But currently, there's no theory that works at times earlier than the Planck time. So if you look at this chart, so this chart is showing all the way back to earlier and earlier times. And you can see it doesn't actually go to zero, right? So they're going a little bit further than I'm going. But the fundamental questions have to do with how quantum gravity works. And those are going to be real hard questions to ever answer. More questions. Well, kind of the plan is to run the movie backwards and then eventually run the movie forward to kind of put it all together. So if we run the movie backwards, the material was all getting more and more dense, and we reach this time when we have ionized material. Right? So this is, it's not actually all that dense. Because if you think about all of the empty space in the universe today, you can collapse it tremendously and still have it not all that dense. So this is, if you're going to think about what the universe was like at this time, and this is again this time 380,000 years after the Big Bang, you should kind of think about it as being like the surface of the sun. Right, every place in the universe, no empty spots. It's always, universe has always been 100% filled. So we're thinking about an object that is thousands of degrees hot. To pick a round number, I'm going to pick 3,000 degrees Kelvin. And what we have here are free-running electrons and protons. And it turns out we're going to have some helium nuclei, which are two neutrons and two protons bound together. These things are all flying around, mostly randomly. After this time period, what's going to happen is we're going to have neutral atoms where the electrons are caught. In these orbits around the individual nuclei. Okay, so this is the difference between ionized material and neutral gas. So just as we were to visit the surface of the sun, there'd be a transition between having neutral gas and ionized gas, all pretty much in this case at a temperature of about 3,000 Kelvin. And because light is absorbed and scattered in the ionized gas, we can't see any further than that. So that's this wall that we see that seems to be in every possible direction surrounding us. Now this whole wall, because of the Doppler effect, is going to be moving away from us at high speeds. And it turns out that this has an expansion factor, a Z factor, of about 1,000. So the wavelength that is produced that would be visible light has now been shifted to microwave frequencies. So we're talking about shifting light from millions of meter into millimeters, going from visible light to microwave light. So if we want to see this wall, we have to use microwave receivers. And this light was first observed in the 60s from Bell Laboratories. So they had big radio antennas that they were using to communicate with satellites to kind of bounce telephone signals from one continent to the next. And they were And they discovered that if they aimed their radio telescope where there wasn't a satellite, you know, where there should be nothing, there was still light coming from that direction. And it was this light that they were directing. They were hearing, as it were, seeing, as it were, the light from this very fast moving away, Doppler shifted to by a factor of 1,000, light that was more or less like the surface of the sun. So that was the start of it, but we want to have all sorts of more data than just that one observation. So the next kind of important work was done by a satellite called COBE. And if this is sunlight, it should have exactly these sort of bell-shaped curves that we've been talking about. And it turns out it's hard to measure this microwave light from ground level, so that COBE was the kind of the first one to try it with extremely high accuracy from space. And what they found was really astounding to those of us watching, because the spectrum exactly matched the spectrum that you would get from a black body radiation. Oh, am I going to be able to do this? Not without a little bit of fast work. Okay, see if I succeeded. Okay, so what? Well, I'm God on this machine, so I can do what I want. Okay, this time for sure. What? There, okay. Ooh, boy, that looks bad, though. Well, I guess this is an occasion where Chrome doesn't work as good as Firefox. Sorry for the delay. I hope this is an occasion. There we go. So this is actual data, and this is the theoretical curve that we've talked about, you know, months ago, with that peak that's at a particular wavelength. In this case, it's being plotted as a function of frequency, and the data just perfectly aligns with the theoretical formula. And the corresponding temperature of this black body is about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. So it's been shifted by this factor of 1,000 that we get because of the Z effect. So 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, emitted at 2,700 degrees, but shifted by the Doppler effect by a factor of 1,000. Actually, it's more like 1,100 if you care about the details. It turns out that this temperature is now one of the most accurately measured temperatures, period. So we know lots of significant digits on this temperature. And you remember what we said about the sun, that we could actually learn what's going on inside the sun by studying the sound that was being created inside the sun. And that would produce extra big Doppler shifts if the surface of the sun was moving towards us or away from us. And by studying the sun's sound, we could actually hear, as it were, inside the sun. So this is actually a very precise map that's maybe a year old from a satellite called WMAP. And it turns out that the light, so this is a representation of the entire sky put onto this kind of oval shape. And the first thing I want to say is that this temperature of the microwave background radiation is extremely uniform to parts per thousand, the first thing you detect is that it seems to be slightly hotter in one direction than another. And that's because the Earth is moving in one direction. And so it is itself causing a Doppler shift, moving towards, say, this wall and away from that wall. So this wall looks a little bit hotter, shifted wavelengths to the blue, whereas this wavelength looks a little bit less. So by looking at this difference in temperature between opposite sides of the universe caused by our motion, we can actually figure out what the motion of the Earth is relative to the universe as a whole. It turns out it's relatively fast, but just hundreds of kilometers per second. So that effect has been subtracted, and what's left is regions where the universe is slightly hot and places where the universe is slightly cooler. And what I mean slightly, I can't overestimate how small the effect is. So this is a part in 100,000. This piece of the universe is just 1/100,000th of a degree hotter than that part of the universe. So incredibly sensitive measurements have to go into to get these very small temperature changes. The satellite COBE that I mentioned before, it was the first satellite to see any hint of a less than perfectly uniform background radiation. And the people involved in that won Nobel Prizes, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so for that work. This is the most recent repeat of that experiment. So the plan is to analyze these sound waves that we're seeing, as it were, in the propagating in the very early universe, and we can see it now, even though it happened 13.7 billion years ago, because we're looking at distant objects. And the plan is to look at the wavelengths that we see and look at the intensity of the light as a function of those wavelengths. And that's what this graph is. So this is a graph of the amount of this extra temperature versus angular scale. So you can see that, roughly speaking, there are blobs that are sound waves that are slightly hotter, about 1 degree away. So if we were to look at the scale about this, this separation, this kind of typical separation you see between the highs and the lows, that's about 1 degree. And there are other oscillations as we look to higher and higher, closer and closer regions of the sky. Not surprisingly, if we look at regions of the sky that are very, very close together, the temperatures can't vary very much because those regions have been in contact with each other. So these are extraordinarily difficult and accurate measurements of the sounds that are occurring in 300,000 years, 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And from them, we can kind of listen in to what's happening at even earlier times. So somebody asked at one point, how do we get all of those digits on this 13.7 billion years? You know, why most numbers that we've had in here have had a whole lot more rounding than three significant digits. And it actually comes from analyzing this data that we get this highly accurate handle on the behavior of the early universe. So that's probably where our best data comes from, is looking at the sound waves that are propagating in this plasma that we see currently, but it was at the time when this light was eliminated, it was on the order of just 400,000 years after the Big Bang. How can we do better than that? Well, we can't use light, and we've already used sound. If we want to push things back to earlier times, we need to have some sort of artifact that was created in the early universe and has survived to current times. And by studying those artifacts created early on, we can get a handle on what the conditions were in the early universe. It'll have to be a pretty robust artifact if it's held together throughout all of that time. It has to be really well stuck together. And the artifact that we are in the business of studying are our nuclei. So at very early times, you know, we look at this chart again, wherever it went to, this one here. So here's this this event that we've been talking about, where the universe went from ionized gas to unionized gas. And incidentally, just explaining some of the ways this diagram works, you notice that this line for light, photons, is the solid line up until that instant, and then it starts to be wavy. So the wavy lines indicate where stuff is flying free. At earlier times, light was confined to making these small steps in the ionized gas, and so it didn't get very far. But here the light is shining free, and we can see it today. You know, it's been shining for 13.7 billion years, basically. And so here it's being called the 3-degree microwave background radiation. That's the round number, right? 2.7, and then more digits of it are known, but at least 2.7. So here we have this transition, universe ionized to universe unionized. And it's also maybe useful to kind of look at the kind of overall scale of things. So at this time, you work up here, you'll see that the density of the universe is way less than the density of the air in this room. Ben?
So that straight line is the 340,000 photons.
Yes. So this is a really funny graph, and maybe I should start by talking about that. You remember those funny graphs we had way early about the scale of the solar system, where Mercury and Pluto all fit on the same graph without being scrunched together? That's the sort of scale we have here, where time is being measured exponentially. Right? So here's now, and here is 9 billion years ago. And we keep expanding time to get very, very small fractions down here. Right? So if you look, here is a factor of a million in terms of time, and a factor of a million in terms of time is the same step size as we work our way forward. Right? So here's about 1 year after the Big Bang. So all of this is 1 year in. So this is a graph that very intentionally expands out the first seconds, the first fraction of a second of the history of the universe. So we can talk about it. It's not all scrunched in. Okay? So, again, at this time, just 400,000 years after the Big Bang, you shouldn't think about it as being dense at that time. It's less dense than the air in this room, less dense than the surface of so-called surface of the sun. Pretty rarefied gas, but hot gas. And it was going to expand a factor of 1,000 in every dimension in the future. So it is a billion times more dense than the current universe is, but the current universe is pretty rarefied. So you could compress it by a factor of a billion and it's still not much there. So to get to interestingly dense stuff, we have to go to earlier time. So here we have the density being comparable to the density of the air in this room. And here we have density comparable to water. So we have to work our way back before we really have stuff that is incredibly unusual compared to what we can do in our laboratories. Right, so someplace in here, you remember I said, is the limit of what we can actually do reproduce in our laboratories. So the laboratory that's outside of Chicago called the Tevatron, it can reproduce situations that are 1 TeV. So we can get to, roughly speaking, there. The one at CERN can get to 10 TeV, so it just gets slightly further along. Okay. So we were looking for artifacts that were created early in the universe that could have survived to the present. And the artifact of interest is nuclei. Because at these very early times, it was too hot for nuclei to exist, right? We know that high temperatures break apart composites. So in the end, at these very early times, all we have are quarks, let alone neutrons and protons. So what we're looking at is this instant here, which is at about 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when the neutrons and protons that then existed get cooked into nuclei. And we've asked this question before, why didn't it all get cooked? So typically at these high temperatures, every possible reaction should go, right? And you know that we had this onion-shaped stars where we're cooking everything to everything else. The highest temperatures were needed to be cooking the silicon to iron. And those temperatures and higher would have existed at this early universe. So why were there any tasty morsels left over after the Big Bang exploded? Why didn't we just have ash after the Big Bang? And the answer has to do with some things that we've talked about before, touched on before, and that is the difficulty of making these reactions go. So you remember that inside the sun, the first reaction are protons combining with protons. But this reaction is extremely rare. Right? On average, it takes 10 billion years for a proton to run into another proton and actually have it stick and turn into deuterium and emit the corresponding antimatter electron and neutrino. That reaction is really difficult to have happen. So we can't get very far throwing protons at protons. Neutrons themselves have a half-life of about 10 minutes or so, maybe closer to 15 minutes, I guess. So there aren't any neutrons that are around currently in this room. Right? They all decayed long ago. But this is just a few minutes after the Big Bang, so there were neutrons at these very early times. So we do have one possible reaction where neutrons and protons can get together to form deuterium. The only other possible reaction you can think of is two neutrons coming together, and it turns out that two neutrons can't combine to form anything. So the only possible reaction in the very early universe is this guy here. But it turns out that deuterium is among the most fragile of the nuclei. And at high temperatures, it spontaneously breaks apart. So iron would stick together if it existed in this very early universe. The temperatures are cool enough to allow iron to form, but the deuterium breaks apart. And we can't get any further than that, right? Because no other possible reaction can go. So only when the temperatures get cool enough for deuterium to exist for a while, then we can go further, right? This thing can eat a proton and go to helium-3, and we can have that thing hit by a neutron and go to helium-4. So once we get some deuterium forming, then we can start to form higher nuclei. But you remember what happens with helium. Once we get helium together, alpha particles, we have the same sort of phenomena. Two alpha particles can come together to form beryllium-8, but beryllium-8 is hugely unstable. It immediately breaks apart. We can't add protons to helium either because lithium-5 is unstable, and we can't add neutrons to helium because there is no such thing as helium-5. So we've got a bottleneck with helium. So we got two bottlenecks. We can't get the process going until it's cool enough for the deuterium to form. So if you look on the back of your page, you'll see a graph like this. So this is, in this particular case, the x-axis is temperature, but they've also labeled things in terms of time, right? Because as the universe expands, it's going to be cooling. So this is the situation at 1 minute after the Big Bang. Here it is at 3 minutes after the Big Bang. Here it is at 1 hour after the Big Bang. And if we look carefully at this, this line here I think that's, is that the, con- no, it can't be, I think that's the concentration of neutrons in the universe. But the main point is that here at about 3 minutes, that's where the cooking starts to occur, and we go from basically no helium to the current amount of helium just as the temperature is falling. And we can't get beyond the production of helium because it requires the triple alpha reaction, right? Three alphas getting together in a short period of time. And the situation at 3 minutes after the Big Bang is not particularly dense gas. It's not like the center of these massive stars where we have many times the normal concentration of stuff. Right? So if we look here at about 3 minutes, the density is just about the density of water. Whereas even the sun has a density that's 10 times that of lead, which is roughly speaking 100 times that of water. So again, even 3 minutes after the Big Bang, the universe is not all that dense, not hugely dense. And so these are the products we get. Mostly helium, a little bit of deuterium, because deuterium is pretty unstable. A little bit of helium-3, hydrogen-3. This is radioactive, and so it's not going to survive very far in the early universe. We get incredibly small amounts. So this is a billion. This is a 10 billionth. We get incredibly small amounts of lithium-7 and beryllium-7. But we don't get much else. So the universe had enough temperature in order to cook everything to iron, but there are these bottlenecks that have to do with production of deuterium and what's required for helium fusion, and they're not satisfied, so we just quit at hydrogen and helium. It doesn't all get cooked into helium because there aren't that many neutrons in order to do that. So we end up with the usual concentration that we've been talking about, where we have roughly speaking 25% by mass helium, 75% mass hydrogen, and everything else is pretty small change. And of course, the way we go from that to what we call cosmic abundance, right, where we start getting these sorts of materials, that requires being cooked in stars, which sit around for more than minutes and have higher densities, so they're able to cook things beyond the helium that we get. Okay, so if you look at, this is kind of a funny graph. So remember, this is an artifact that's left over from the Big Bang. The amount of helium, the amount of deuterium, the amount of helium-3, the amount of lithium-7, it's an artifact. And we can calculate how much of those things would be produced under different conditions. Here we've labeled the condition being the present density of the universe, where we've undone the expansion. But we can now go and measure the amount of helium, the amount of deuterium, the amount of helium-3, and we can figure out what the conditions had to be at that time in order to produce exactly those ratios of those early elements. Okay. So by looking at nucleosynthesis, that gives us a handle on what the conditions were 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when that cooking occurred. Okay. Well, let's switch back to this bomb picture. So So here we have neutral atoms with light being, with the universe being transparent. Here we have ionized nuclei. Here we have the production of those nuclei. If we go back to earlier times, what we've got are neutrons, which again still exist because they have a half-life of 15 minutes, and we haven't gone through 15 minutes of the universe yet. You might notice that there's also this transition between where the neutrino lines go from being straight to where they'd be going wavy. So you know that neutrinos are incredibly non-interactive. So kind of no surprise, the universe becomes transparent to neutrinos at very early times. And so there should be this omnipresent background of neutrinos that are left over from the Big Bang, just as there are these photons that are left over from the Big Bang. These photons came from basically 400,000 years after the Big Bang. These neutrinos came from about a second after the Big Bang. So if we could measure the characteristic of these omnipresent neutrinos, we could also learn something about the situation just a second after the Big Bang. So we've talked about measuring the behavior of neutrinos. So we can measure the neutrinos from the sun, but we have copious amounts of those neutrinos. And it also turns out that those neutrinos are particularly reactive. These neutrinos are incredibly non-reactive, and currently no one has detected these neutrinos. And it's a real difficult process to do it, but it's something that people have in the back of their minds for some century in the future, to be able to see these objects, these relics that are left over from 1 second after the Big Bang. So if we go back to earlier times than that, what the universe consists of is antimatter electrons and electrons in almost equal number, in addition to these neutrons and protons and neutrinos and, of course, the light that has been present all along. Right, so that's this line here. Neutrinos, antineutrinos, plus and minus electrons, matter and antimatter electrons, and neutrons and protons, all more or less in equal number at these early times. Well, what happened to these antimatter electrons? Well, at about the same time that the neutrinos fly free, there's a massive annihilation of those electrons. There are almost as many antimatter electrons as there are normal electrons. These things are going to annihilate to produce light. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of energy that's released at that time. And that difference in energy is the difference between this 2 degrees above absolute zero and this 3 degrees above absolute zero. That is to say, what happened in here is the reheating of the universe because of this big annihilation. And that actually leads to the most important relic we have of the early universe, and that's the fact that we're not made of equal mixes of matter and antimatter. So at this moment, we had 1 billion antielectrons and 1,000,000,001 electrons, and we had almost all of them annihilated, but we had not an exact equality. We had a slight excess of normal electrons over antimatter electrons, and that's why we have electrons today. So in the early universe, everything should be more or less co-equal, matter and antimatter, right? At high enough temperatures, all composites are going to be broken apart. But for some reason, we had a slight excess of matter over antimatter. And of course, that slight excess of matter over antimatter, less than a part in a billion, is why we have matter around today, as opposed to having a complete annihilation at those early times. So that's something that needs to be explained, the origin of the matter and antimatter asymmetry. And you can see that that's being traced to these very early times, giving us a hint of what's happening at times well before we can simulate in our laboratories. Okay, so more Big Bang next time. Run the movie forward next time.